Welcome to New Books in Language. Today, in the second part of an interview with Professor James Herford, we discuss his new book, The Origins of Grammar. This volume takes up the task of offering an account of how human syntax could have evolved. The book first discusses the limitations of other species' syntactic abilities, then characterizes those of humans. Finally, drawing upon theoretical and practical work from many disciplines, a proposal is offered as to how this gap could have been bridged in evolutionary terms. In this interview, we talk about various facets of this book. We discuss why researchers in animal cognition sometimes underestimate the evolutionary challenge of human syntax, and how developments in syntax have made the evolutionary approach more acceptable to the linguistic mainstream. And we talk about the idea of the symbolic niche as being the venue for the rapid co-evolution of human language and culture. Today I'm talking to Professor James Herford about the second volume of his work on Language in the Light of Evolution, The Origins of Grammar. Jim, this is a much larger volume than The Origins of Meaning. Does that reflect the complexity of the evolutionary processes that are postulated, or is it more the extensive nature of the theoretical prerequisites?
I think it's very much the latter. Syntax has been a maelstrom of debate in the last 50 years, and I think the dominant position that's been taken has been rather extreme. It has a lot to recommend it, but it has also some problems when you try to consider how language could have evolved. So a lot of scene setting was needed in this case. And also it must be said that syntactic structure and phonological structure are further away from the empirical facts, if you like, from the tangible facts. And so there's much more room for theorizing there. And people have taken that liberty and theorized quite widely. So some sorting out needed to be done.
You begin by looking at some of the potential precursors to human syntax in other domains, such as birdsong, also the song of whales.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that some non-linguists have tended to overstate the similarities with human language, and perhaps linguistic syntacticians have tended to overstate the differences?
I think that's right. On the whole, I think that the non-linguists have overstated the similarities more than the linguists have overstated the differences. Mm-hmm. The overlap between birdsong and whale song and human language is in they're both having phrases of some kind. In human language, phrases are defined semantically, basically, whereas in birdsong and whale song, you can identify what they call phrases by the fact that the same sequence is repeated over and over again. So there's some kind of a unit there, which is probably controlled as a unit in the animal's brain. And repeated over and over. It's been called a phrase in the animal song literature. And they are to some extent hierarchically organized, like human language. But the big difference is that words and phrases in human language have meaning. They're semantically characterized, and the meaning of a whole sentence is a composition of the meanings of the parts. And that's just not the case with birdsong and whale song.
Do you feel that evolutionary approaches to syntax have tended to neglect the role of meaning?
There hasn't been much in the way of evolutionary approaches to syntax. Probably the most prominent is Derek Bickerton, and he has not ignored the connection to meaning. So for him, an early stage is what he called proto-language. And that's meaningful words, words which are actually attached to their reference, strung together in an agrammatical way. I think what syntacticians have done is emphasize that the big step that humans took was syntax, that is, the capacity to form complex structures, stringing words together. What they have not taken into account so much is the importance of meaning itself. That is, the things we string together, the words, already have a meaning. That gives a lot of impetus to the mechanisms which then go on and string words together. So I think symbolism and stringing words together are equally important. And symbolism came first, that is, having meaningful units came first. That's a difference of emphasis from mainstream syntactic theory, which has placed most of the emphasis on the complex stringing together of words, and kind of inferring that it wasn't such a big deal to have words, meaningful words, in the first place. I think that's a false emphasis.
It's something of a recurring theme that there are some points of departure with perhaps not contemporary syntax, but traditional syntactic theories, which serve to make the transition from proto-language slightly smoother or more plausible. One thing that strikes me is your emphasis on quantitative constraints in language.
Yes.
Particularly, your view is that computational constraints such as working memory in some sense filter the input data available to the child language learner. What are the implications of that for the system?
I think the implications are very profound. So the traditional mainstream object of study in syntax has been competence, and there's been an insistence on the separation of competence from performance. I don't want to undermine the distinction between competence and performance. I think it's a very reasonable distinction. There have been people who have attacked the distinction, and I think they're wrong. On the other hand, I think that you can't consider one without paying some attention to the other. So beginning linguistic students are taught, for example, routinely taught, that there's an infinite number of sentences in a language, and that this is clearly a matter of competence. It's not obviously not an empirical fact that there's an infinite number of sentences in a language. It can't be empirically verified because you can't ever live long enough to count an infinite number. So it's a consequence of taking a particular theoretical stance that there's an infinite number of sentences in a language. Another example where theoretical concerns have overridden what I think are actually sensible concerns of performance is the case of multiple center embedding. So an example would be actors, women, men like idolize get rich, or a slightly more complicated one, actors, women, men, mothers spoiled like idolize get rich. Now, if you see those written down and say them over to yourself slowly, you can figure out what they would mean. But they're impossible to process online in real time, which is the real circumstances in which language is used, and the real circumstances in which language evolved. So it seems to me that what linguists typically have been carried away by is theorizing in a paper and pencil way about the consequences of simple rules that they can observe if extended quantitatively. So if there is no numerical limit on the application of those rules. And in life, there clearly is a numerical limit. The argument's been made that that we should separate these two domains, that that performance is really nothing to do with the language system itself. But my counter-argument is that the language system itself couldn't have evolved without the prop of performance. So you, in order to work with any grammar, you need memory, you need processing, and the processing constraints would have evolved at the same time as the complexity of the systems, the rather more abstract systems, that are being processed and stored in memory.
Am I right in recalling that Chomsky, in his very early work, was quite interested in the notion of quantitative depth of, for example, possible embedding, but then succumbed to the idealization, which then became so widespread?
Yes, very, very early on, there was an article. I'm thinking of the name Hilary Putnam, but I think that's probably wrong. There was a linguist writing in the 1960s who did suggest some numerical limits on embedding. And I think Chomsky very, very briefly entertained this idea, but I'm pretty sure he left it very soon. It doesn't figure in his kind of theorizing.
What do you think the attraction is of the idealization that we could, for example, ignore quantitative considerations?
The attraction is that it's easy. It's very comfortable. It's an example of trying to find your keys where the light is best and not where you left them. And you can sit in your armchair and theorize and have intuitions about what would be the case if simple rules were allowed to apply over and over again without numerical limits. And you don't actually have to go and observe what limitations exist in real life. It's also rather messy. So as soon as you start getting into statistics, it's not so neat and tidy a study. That's the attraction.
You identify that the quantitative constraints enable you to posit languages which cross-cut the usual distinctions that are made in the Chomsky hierarchy, as it's sometimes been called. Yeah. What are the implications of that?
The Chomsky hierarchy is in a way a beautiful thing, but it's posited on infinite languages, infinite sets of sentences, and of course no creature lives in a situation in which it's got at its disposal a literally infinite set of sentences. So all life is limited quantitatively. You don't live forever, and you can't make calls that last forever. So the applicability of the Chomsky hierarchy is very indirect. As soon as you start putting numerical limits on it, saying, well, I'm only talking about strings which are, say, up to 10 words long or up to 100 words long, then the whole thing falls apart completely. Nevertheless, I do think there's something to it. That is, the kind of memory needed to work with context-free phrase structure grammars, even at with limits of, say, 15 words, involves a richer structure, a richer mental structure, than what's involved if you were working with a finite state grammar, what's typically called a finite state grammar. In this book, I call them chain state grammars. So there's some kind of extra mechanism needed, even to do context-free grammars when they're restricted numerically. So there's some value in the hierarchy, but it becomes impossible, at least so far, to draw a neat hierarchy with the numbers added in. You know, that is to say that a context-free language with length of string 10, for example, has more or less computational power than a finite state grammar with some other numerical limit on it. So that hasn't proved possible. And I don't think people have tried it, because it seems very hard to see how you'd go about it. In the discussion of birdsong, I've got a case where I do argue on neurological grounds, on grounds of bird neuroscience, that a context-free phrase structure grammar account is to be preferred over a state chain or finite state grammar account of the bird song, because you can identify two nuclei in the bird's brain which are rather plausibly identified with different levels in the bird song. So one level called higher vocal center, which represents, it seems to me, the higher phrase, and then a lower part of the brain, so-called RA, which actually spells out the individual notes. I still think there's some reasonable mileage to be got out of a distinction between, for example, context-free phrase structure grammars and finite state grammars, but one must always remember that they're numerically constrained. And then coming up with a formal theory of the relation between these types of grammars with numbers thrown in is very difficult.
I was going to take up that birdsong point. You resist the temptation to be reductionist, if you like, in positing absolutely minimal capacities to birds on the basis that you think there is neurological evidence that they're actually entertaining something slightly more complex than the minimum descriptively adequate grammar.
Yes.
Do you think neural studies can generally inform our understanding of where we and other species lie in this hierarchy?
I think they may be able to. So the difficulty, I think, is this, and I go into it towards the end of the book. In the birdsong case, there's only one level of hierarchy. So there's a phrase which consists of a certain sequence of notes, and that phrase is repeated over and over again. So there's basically just one level. As soon as we've got hierarchical phrase structure in language, we can embed much more deeply. In the bird neuroscience, you could find a single nucleus which corresponded to the phrasal level, and it's only got one phrasal level. But in human language, there are multiple phrasal levels, phrases within phrases within phrases. And it hasn't been possible to find any brain center like the bird center, which emits, if you like, or puts out or controls phrases embedded inside each other. There's a study by two authors, Joubeau and someone else, I forget his name, dealing with humans carrying out multiple hierarchical tasks. And they do identify a couple of places in the brain which are responsible for higher-level organization and lower-level organization. But the problem with their account is still that it couldn't possibly be applied to embedding at depths greater than one, phrases within phrases within phrases. So I don't know what mileage there is in neuroscience in a human case. And here, of course, the Chomskyan insistence on the recursive operation of merge is very important. So this is something that we humans can do, not indefinitely, but to much greater depths than any animal can combine notes. And I suspect that the motivation is semantic, that is, we do it because we have complex thoughts that we want to express.
Turning to the next phase of your book, another point of departure from a classic generative approach is your use of construction grammar, although, as you point out, this is hardly heretical nowadays. Do you feel there's a direction of travel in syntax that makes it more open to accommodating evolutionary concerns?
Yes, I think there is. And as you said, I think construction grammar is more amenable. What's been ignored in traditional approaches to syntax is the existence of complex lexical units. So we tended to think of the items in a lexicon as being simple words. That's not completely true, obviously. But what's been ignored is the fact that if you allow that what's stored in the lexicon is more complex, then what you've got is actually a store of constructions rather than a store of words. So to take a simple example, if you take a verb like give, what give brings along with it is three slots, three grammatical slots. So it's not just the verb give. It's a whole structure with the verb give at the center and then slots marked with their thematic roles. Then idioms, of course, are another example, and it's always been acknowledged that idioms should be stored in the lexicon. And idioms are complex. They're syntactically complex. And they have syntactic structure. So, a classic example like spill the beans and so on is clearly a verb phrase, and it's got a verb in it, and it's got a noun phrase in it, and the noun phrase is definite. And it's always been acknowledged that we store those. But there's no one has taken this to beyond that, to a whole construction-like units, which have got a bit of syntactic structure in them, like a whole phrase. In the case of an idiom like spill the beans, the words are filled in. But the only difference between an idiom construction and a non-idiom construction is that there's an empty slot in what's stored for other things to be filled in. Even in idioms, like spill the beans, there's an empty slot for the tense marker. You can say, he will spill the beans, or he did spill the beans, or he has spilled the beans, and so on. So there's still a little bit of space for a variable, even in an idiom construction like that. So the view that's taken in construction grammar is that what's stored is not just a list of words, but a list sometimes of words, simple words, but also of bigger and bigger constructions, some of which have a lot of empty space in them with specified slots for variables to be fitted in from other constructions.
We'll come back to the evolutionary implications of that, which you discuss in the third section, but before you do, another perhaps controversial idea that you raise in the second part of your book, which is also relevant to the evolutionary approach, is the idea that there are, out of the set of wholly legitimate human native languages, these actually vary in complexity,
yeah.
where this is actually quite casually denied rather widely in the literature. Why do you think that is?
Why do I think it's denied?
Yes.
I think it's for reasons of political correctness. And I think this was appropriate maybe 50 years ago when there was perhaps in the population at large a widespread assumption that languages of people with simple material cultures had to be simple. And linguists had to get over the hurdle of persuading people that, American Indian languages or Australian Aboriginal languages were very, very complicated and perhaps more complicated in some ways than their favorite European languages or like classical languages. So it was completely appropriate that we insisted that we don't assume from the start that languages of less developed peoples are more simple. Having said that, now that we think we're over that, we've won that battle, then we can relax and actually look at the facts a bit more objectively and realize that, in fact, languages are not all equally complex. It's obvious if you think of the subsystems of language. So some languages have subsystems which are more complex than the corresponding subsystems of other languages. So, Latin and Russian have case systems, and English has very little in the way of a case system. Finnish and Hungarian have masses of cases. Bantu languages have very complex noun class systems, which we don't. And then if you look to see if there's some kind of payoff, there used to be a kind of hand-waving argument that if you found complexity in one part of a language, then it was compensated by simplicity in another part of the language. That turns out not to be true. So a language which has, a complicated case system may also have a complicated noun class system, for example. So these complexities in a language add up, and you can get languages which are more complex than others.
Of course, one thing that doesn't go through is the equivalence that these simple material cultures have languages that could be at all a good candidate for early language in the sense of proto-language, because as you point out, they're extremely complex.
They can be extremely complex. They're not necessarily extremely complex. So to jump along a bit, I think what's happened in the long history of language on Earth over a couple of hundred thousand years is that during the time when tribes were spreading out and were more or less isolated from each other, living in small groups of maybe no more than 100 or perhaps up to 1,000, then complex morphology in particular developed. Then at a certain time when the world was getting more and more full up with humans and there was more contact, empires and trade started to happen. At that point, the languages were more and more learned by adults as second languages, and that tends to be a simplifying case. It's well known that Indo-European languages have lost a lot of their productive inflectional morphology over the past couple of thousand years. And there's always been a bit of a puzzle in historical linguistics. How could languages have got, in the first place, so complicated as ancient Greek and Sanskrit? And what we've seen of their history ever since is simplification. And I think the answer is a social one. The tribes and the groups who developed the complex morphological structures were living in isolation from each other. All the languages were learned by first language learners, by children. There wasn't much influence of people learning the language as second language or developing pidgin languages for trade. And so there was the possibility of them getting inflectionally more complex, and the inflectional complexity has actually broken down since extensive contact between language groups. Obviously, it's a statistical thing. So, you can look at some big languages which are still inflectionally very complex, like Russian, and you can look at Chinese, which is obviously a very big language, which is just the opposite, highly isolating, no inflectional morphology to speak of. So it is a statistical matter.
Is this a view which is, you think, gaining currency, or are people more inclined to continue with the assumption of equal complexity and only circular long-term changes?
I think it is a view that's gaining currency. Peter Trudgill has recently produced a book which argues this, and he and a couple of other people co-edited a book a few years ago pushing the same line. I think it's widely becoming acknowledged, and I don't think there's any influence of generative thought which is pushing one way or the other. For example, I know David Lightfoot, who's a prominent generativist, has said he could see no reason. He said this in print. He could see no reason why all languages are equally complex. So I think even the generativists would agree that there's no big theoretical issue there.
Actually, you make this point, the lack of theory critical nature of this data for generativism, with respect to the controversial case of Pirahã and the the issue of whether the lack of recursion is theoretically significant. You would incline to the view that it isn't, really. It's a bit of a storm in a teacup, is that right?
Yes, I think the Pirahá so-called controversy is a bit of a storm in a teacup. I think Dan Everett has pushed it too far, and I think the people who reacted to it, to Dan Everett's initial claims, probably overreacted as well. Pirahá obviously is in some ways a very simple language. In other ways, it's a very complicated language. There are also other languages which lack subordinate clauses, or at least have very, very few subordinate clauses, certainly in use. So I don't think Pirahá is particularly unusual from that respect. I think that's the kind of answer that the generativist should have given, rather than actually trying to grapple with the Pirahá data and say, look, Pirahá really does have embedding and subordinate clauses, because the data is very hard to get at. And largely it's a matter of what you think the right translations are into English from Pirahá sentences. There's one case that where Everett and Nevins and the other people disagree, and basically the disagreement boils down to how you would best translate into English a particular Pirahá sentence. Now, that's a very subjective matter, and I think it's going to be very hard to come up with any proper answer there.
It's rather redolent of the controversy about Native American languages in the days of Seeker and Wolf.
Yes.
In the third part of the book, we've talked a little about the ideas about language simplifying, but you first need to explore how the complexification took place. You talk about the pre-existing platform of the abilities of our hominin ancestors. It's my impression that you're generally more cautious than some people in reading, for example, recursion into non-linguistic behaviours. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, I am. I think the big difference is that we can manage to control recursion in producing sentences such as the one I'm producing now without any feedback from the outside world. So there are examples where people talk about hierarchical behavior, hierarchically organized behavior. So Patricia Greenfield's got a case where she's talking about babies lifting spoons, and another experimental case where she gets children to nest little boxes inside each other and so on. And the argument that they put forward is that you can see hierarchical organization in their way of doing these things. But the important difference between that and managing a long, complicated, hierarchically organized sentence, such as the one I'm producing now, is that when you're dealing with spoons and putting them in your mouth and dealing with little boxes that you put inside one another, you're getting feedback from the environment all the time. Whereas what I'm doing when I produce a sentence like this involves no feedback whatsoever. I'm embarking on the sentence and holding quite a complicated structure in my head while I spin out the words which correspond to that structure. And I'm keeping all that hierarchical structure in my head all at once. And I don't think there's any example at all in the animal world or in human non-linguistic behavior which has that feature. That is, that it's hierarchically organized and not prompted by feedback from the world. Ray Jackendoff talks about hierarchical organization involved in making coffee. But in his example, again, all the hierarchical, the different routines that you go through are prompted by feedback from the world. You know, you have the coffee beans and you have the coffee container and so on.
Another point you raise in that connection, I'm not sure whether it's the same point under just a slightly different name, is the matter of affordances, which are provided to us by physical objects, but which presumably aren't by words, for example.
Yes. I think the idea of affordances has been very profitable in non-linguistic psychology. And I think, metaphorically at least, one can extend the idea actually in a way which jibes quite well with construction grammar. So I mentioned the example of the word give, the English word give, and it brings with it a certain structure. It brings with it thematic role slots. And you can think of these as the affordances, the grammatical affordances of the word give. So each word brings with it ways of integrating it with other words, ways of dealing with it. And those are the affordances of a cup, or, you know, ways in which it presents itself, which allow you to deal with it in particular ways. And words you could say a bit metaphorically, bring their own affordances with them, in that they have particular specific ways of blending in, being combined with other words. You could call those affordances, but I think it's a metaphorical step.
Turning to the matter of the process that's taking place, you characterize the very substantial changes in human linguistic evolution in terms of the co-evolution of genes and language. In particular, you articulate this idea of humans occupying the symbolic niche.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that?
Yes. We're very impressed by the ways in which computers, for example, have changed our lives. Over the past 20 years, we can do things which we absolutely couldn't have dreamed of doing 20 years ago, like having a conversation over Skype. Now, I think that a revolution in human life of even greater scale happened when we first started taking the noises that other people make as not just for themselves, but as actually triggering thoughts about the world in our head. So as soon as our environment included not just physical things, but things which stood for physical things that we could think about and which were not present in the environment itself, that expanded the whole mental life of human beings in a way which was just not there before. So that's the symbolic niche, if you like. It's, again, a bit metaphorical, stretching the word niche, perhaps beyond what biologists would be happy with. But nevertheless, this new kind of behavior, symbolic behavior, completely changed the playing field in which people had to survive. They had to learn to use the same symbols as other people in the group, and they had to be able to respond to the noises that other people make as if those noises stood for real life situations that they had experienced, but were not experiencing at the time. So a whole new mental life was introduced with the use of symbols.
And this is something that's influenced our evolutionary development itself in the way that you liken in certain places to the idea of domestication.
Yes. I think that's a slightly separate issue, but it's related and parallel. So when we talked last time about cooperation in the context of pragmatics, it's clear that humans, within groups at least, are far more cooperative with each other and can read each other's minds and figure out each other's intentions and decide to join in participating in those intentions to a far greater degree than other species can. Now, it seems to me at least an appealing idea that humans have selected each other over the course of time for these qualities. It's noticeable in domesticated animals. The situation is a bit complicated, but as a very general rule of thumb, domesticated animals are better at interacting with humans in symbolic ways. Figuring out where a human is, why a human is pointing at something, for example, figuring out the significance of pointing anyway. So domesticated animals are better at that than non-domesticated animals. So that's the beginnings of communication in a human-like way. And it seems plausible then to ask whether humans count as a domesticated species. Well, Darwin thought of this idea and dismissed it because he couldn't think of who might have domesticated humans and didn't consider the idea that we domesticated ourselves. So the mechanics of it would be that offspring who are actually a bit more amenable, a bit easier to get along with, a bit more cooperative, would have been favored. And mates who are a bit more amenable and a bit more cooperative would have been favored. And so you get a kind of natural selection for cooperation, mind reading, participating in group activities, and so on.
This is probably not a very fair question, but how substantial are the actual genotypic changes that have been undertaken in this process? You talk at some point about an estimate that was made about the information that was relevant to language that had been changed in the human genotype since the split with
I think the problem with genetic studies so far is that we've only got a very, very limited idea of what particular genes do. So, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the FOXP2 gene, and it's quite clear that FOXP2 is a gene which is involved in language. But it's not the only one. Language is a very complicated thing. And, you know, there can't be a gene, a single gene, for example, for having hierarchical phrasal structure. There has to be a framework of performance, including memory limitations and processing power, which support the use of complex hierarchical structure. And this would have been provided and fostered by other genes. So there's a whole range of genes which are involved in complex language behavior. And so far, we know very little about what these genes are. In the course of our descent from the common ancestor of chimps, and even going back further, it's clear that there's been acceleration in genes controlling development, brain development in particular. So going back beyond the beginning of humans, even with the evolution of primates themselves, there's been accelerated brain development. So specific selection for genes related to brain development all through the primate lineage. So that starts way before humans start. And that's a fairly solid conclusion, I think, of genetic studies. So it reinforces the idea that that language didn't just spring onto the scene in one moment, and that it was built up over many, many thousands of years, probably millions of years, as a complex set of capacities, and only finally blossomed in the last couple of hundred thousand years. But nevertheless, the platform on which it was built was being built started to be built a long time before that.
Taking up the idea of language blossoming, when you turn in your last chapter to the trajectory of syntactic evolution, my impression is that the later stages are somewhat easier. I don't know whether is that the case in your view, or is it just that the processes are more widely studied that have given us the extension of language?
Yes. I draw on studies of grammaticalization, and what studies of grammaticalization have built on is classical historical linguistics. So there are many cases, as we discussed in the last interview, where, for example, auxiliary verbs have developed out of main verbs, where adpositions have developed out of nouns. In some cases, adpositions have developed out of verbs, things like that. I took up the challenge of using grammaticalization theory to account for much more basic features of human language, such as the basic division between nouns and verbs, the basic division and the basic division between subject and predicate. So the last chapter involves quite a bit of speculation about how that could have happened, and I draw on child language to some extent there as examples. But I think a coherent story can be told starting from simple two-word utterances in which the first word is a deictic, like that, and the second word is some predicating word, like lion. You might say that lion, meaning that's a lion. I think a coherent story can be told, building from such simple structures as that, of how you get, first of all, a distinction between function words and non-function words, between function words and content words. So in the example I've just given, that is a deictic element and is a function word, and the predicating word lion is a content word. So the first distinction that emerged is this very, very basic distinction in languages between function words and content words. And then very soon, according to my story, you can get a distinction between nouns and verbs. And then you can also get a distinction between subject position in a sentence and other positions in sentences. So what I undertook was to extend the strategy of grammaticalization theory backwards to much more basic elements of language than had been attempted before. And the historical linguist may well take a dim view of this, because they're, on the whole, very cautious about speculating back more well, back beyond the kinds of languages that we see around us today.
I suppose an issue is whether the whether these claims are falsifiable in principle, or whether there are alternative explanations. I mean, what do you think would be good evidence for the support of a claim like this? Would you appeal to, for example, developmental studies or evolutionary simulations or something else?
Well, evolutionary simulations all depend on the assumptions that you build in. So I don't think you can prove the coherence of a theory with a computational simulation, but you can't prove that it's actually what happened. You can show with computational simulations that something could possibly have happened because the factors interacted in a certain way that's predictable. But computational simulation won't actually tell you what did happen. Nothing will, of course. I mean, it's all speculation because we can't time travel back 200,000 years to see what people were doing then. So the only relevant evidence we've got is child language, the development of new languages like Nicaraguan Sign Language and pigeons, for example. The use of child language has to be, of course, very carefully handled, and the best evidence from child language is where children come up with behavior which is not exemplified in the adult behavior. So an example I mention in the book is where children, and this is very common, actually use English accusative pronouns like me as a subject of a sentence. So I heard a little kid once say, "Me come to party," and he wouldn't ever have heard an adult say that, but it came out naturally for him. And so in cases where children are spontaneously producing things which the adults around them don't produce, I think it's reasonable to assume that this is the kind of thing that could spontaneously have been produced by the very earliest humans when, again, there was no one around to give them examples. They were producing these examples for the first time. But it is all admittedly extremely speculative. I don't think there's anything wrong with speculation, so long as you admit that it's speculation. And many things that are taken very seriously in science, like what happened in the first trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, are also, of course, very speculative, but not fairy tales. Talk about the evolution of languages being dismissed by Chomsky as fairy tales. In these accounts that I and my colleagues come up with, there are no fairies, no fictitious entities. We don't appeal to magic. We appeal to whatever evidence there is, and it's all very circumstantial.
I was going to ask at this point about the Chomsky quote that you cite on page 548. Writing in 1975, he remarks rather scathingly on the prospect of being able to characterize neuroscience in terms of natural selection. He writes, it would be a serious error to suppose that all properties or the interesting properties of the structures that evolved, referring to the brain, can be, quotes, explained, unquote, in terms of natural selection. Do you feel that the field has moved on in terms of the discoveries that have taken place since then, that we've abandoned certain problematic syntactic assumptions that sort of licensed that view, or do you feel that that view was somewhat aberrant all along?
Chomsky's a master rhetorician, and it's interesting that he said there, if I recall what you read out from him correctly, it would be a serious mistake to think that all characteristics of language can be attributed to natural selection. Well, he's setting up a straw man there. I mean, it's reasonable to think that some characteristics of natural language are due to natural selection, and it's not clear that anyone suggested that they all were. So, you know, that's a bit of a rhetorical device. The studies that I mentioned earlier about natural selection for brain development in primates are now very solid, and I think we've got ways now, which we didn't have 20 years ago, of identifying fingerprints of natural selection in the genome. You know, we can actually look at areas of the genome where what the geneticists call a selective sweep seems to have taken place. And the most reasonable interpretation of those genetic facts is that there has been natural selection for particular capacities encoded by these genes.
Turning to the future, then, you talk in the section on those genetic studies. You discuss the fact that, as things stand, the relation of the genes that are known to have evolved particularly rapidly, or surmised to have evolved particularly rapidly in humans, to actual structures in the phenotype are not very clear at this time.
Yes.
Do you think that that's going to be, that finding out those connections is going to be the source of the next, if you will, set of breakthroughs with respect to understanding language? Or do you feel that that's going to come from some other direction?
No, I think it may happen. We don't know whether it'll happen. I mean, the way genes interact with each other is extremely complicated. So the FOXP2 gene down-regulates or up-regulates both about 50 other genes. It switches on and switches off about 50 other genes. And, you know, and they themselves may well switch on and switch off other genes. So it's extremely complicated. But the geneticists are pretty impressive at starting to figure out how some of that stuff can happen. So that there may well be some significant progress in the next 10, 20 years in that area. And I think, you know, linguists should watch it with great interest.
Our time is coming to an end. I normally like to ask, as I will ask, what you're planning to do next in terms of research. But I'd also like to ask, if I may, what you would be doing, what you would be leaning towards doing if you were entering the field now, if that turns out to be something different.
What I'm doing now is kind of an antidote to two big books. One of the reviewers of the book we're talking about now said it's a pity that that Herford can't write a short book that people could take in much more easily. So I'm actually writing that now, Language Origins, A Slim Guide, and it's planned to be no more than 65,000 words long, which is nice and slim, and I hope to argue for a lot of the things I'm arguing in the big book, the big two books in that guide. So I'm pretty busy with that. It's almost done. It's about 80% done, and with luck, it might even appear in 2013, certainly in 2014. Right, the other question, if I were coming into the field now, well, I think what happens in one's career is that one, as one matures, it certainly has happened in my case, one begins to stop being preoccupied with rather narrow questions and start being more concerned with broader questions, or at least to start relating things from outside one's direct field. So a young scholar inevitably has to start by grappling with small, rather limited questions because they don't have enough experience of other disciplines to interact with. I would encourage young scholars starting off to be as inquisitive and curious as possible about other disciplines and try to see how they could relate to their own. I remember a long time ago when I was young reading about so-called zoosemiotics. A man called Shebyok was at that time very interested in animal communication and behavior. And at that time, I could see absolutely no connection at all between human language and animal behavior. I think that's a pity. If young scholars could be encouraged to begin to see links between their own subject and other subjects, that would be a good thing. On the other hand, I think that what the field desperately also needs is lots of empirical studies. So I applaud the efforts of people like Tecumseh Fitch, who actually go out and study animals in the wild and so on. And I applaud the studies of psycholinguists who do artificial language learning studies in the lab to see what humans do in somewhat unrealistic circumstances, but nevertheless experimentally controlled circumstances. I think there's actually a lot more to be done for birdsong too. I keep being fascinated by blackbird song, which seems more complicated than the stuff that chaffinch song and zebrafinch song that the birdsong researchers have worked on. It seems to me there's more structure in blackbird song than one might find in those others. So I'd be tempted to do empirical work, but hoping that empirical work would not dominate my thinking in such a way that I didn't pay attention to the connections between narrow empirical questions and broader questions.
Well, we're very grateful to you for bringing all these many empirical and theoretical strands together so eloquently. And I look forward very much to reading the next book. But in the meantime, let me say, Jim Herford, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I've been talking to James Herford about his book, The Origins of Grammar. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.